Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Before we get to our guest, I want to remind everyone that we begin our show every single day. We have for months. We will continue to do it through the election of the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. If you want to know what the voice of a patriot sounds like, listen to Vindman. If you want to understand why immigration is such an important policy for America and that we should open our arms to so many people, meet Colonel Vindman. So there's just a lot that I think that you really need to hear. And now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I love the prospect, the American prospect, prospect.org. And Harold Meyerson wrote this really, it's a charming piece, Harold, I have to tell you. It's entitled Unconventional Wisdom, Covering This Year's Conventions Minus the Conventions. And it's a history lesson as much as anything else. And it sort of gives us sort of the ebb and flow of all the conventions you were at, including the 1968 convention, which, you probably still have maybe some scars from that convention, but it's a great arc of history. And I think it does sort of in some ways prepare us a little bit for tonight, but in a lot of ways, no one is prepared for tonight. No one sort of imagined anything quite like this. There's such energy when you go to conventions of people congregating and meeting people from different states and, you know, comparing notes, and none of that kind of juice is going to happen. But there may be something else that happens as well. So one, welcome to the program, Harold Meyerson, editor at large at the American Prospect. And let's talk a little bit about your sort of your history lesson through the eyes of your experience.
Well, actually, I left out what really is my first convention experience, which is 1960 nominating John Kennedy in Los Angeles. I was 10 years old and my parents had tickets to the second night. All I remember is sort of Adlai Stevenson's unannounced sudden appearance. And Stevenson, I think rather wrongly, was the darling of liberals, and there was a huge ovation for him. And that was that. Now, he was nominated for president by a young Minnesota senator named Eugene McCarthy. And my first real convention was when I was 18. I was in between high school and college, and I was about the youngest person on McCarthy's campaign staff. Now, it was clear, you know, he arrived in Chicago. He wasn't going to win, but there were platform fights, and I remember taking messages to and fro McCarthy delegates on the floor of that convention. Of course, this is the famous Chicago cop riot convention. On the last night of the convention, I should say that the follow-up report officially on what happened in Chicago termed what the police did a police riot. But by the last night, the police were facing a problem. They had run out of people to beat up on the streets and in the parks and on the sidewalks. So they somehow or other, overlooking the main park, the Conrad Hilton Hotel, the McCarthy Jr. staff was on the 15th floor of that hotel. And around 3 a.m., we were all sort of saying goodbye after having spent months together. They suddenly emerged from the service elevator swinging their clubs. And so it was sort of a supply side police riot, not a demand side. They were, they were all geared up and had no place to go. So that was my first convention. Nothing quite like that since. But I've been to, first as an activist, and then as a journalist since 1992, I've been to pretty much every Democratic convention starting in the, I think, 1980. And once I was a journalist, most Republican conventions too. And they do offer really a kind of density of politics.
Yes.
You can go state caucus to state caucus, see what's going on there. The different interest group caucuses, the labor caucuses, the finance, if you can get into the finance committees, that's always fun. That's got the best drinks and the best hors d'oeuvres. And,
surprise.
Yes, yes. You never know what may happen. Certainly Barack Obama's ascent really began with his speech at the 2004 convention when he was just a state senator, though already the Senate nominee from Illinois. Tonight I think the convention keynote is going to be somewhat awkwardly divided among 17 young Democrats who will give the, the oral equivalent of tweets, little Twitter, comments, and we'll see how that goes. I'm sorry, this is for Monday night, and I know this show is later. But
that's fine. That's fine. Yeah. I've already warned people, so it's okay.
Okay. And I think we'll see some an attempt at ideological balance tonight, because the first night will feature a couple Republicans, John Kasich and Susan Molinari, and then Bernie Sanders. So in some planners' grand design, this clearly is supposed to be a way to achieve a certain balance. Well, if you didn't like Bernie, look at those Republicans. Well, if you didn't like the Republicans, we've got Bernie. So that's the kickoff evening.
Well, what's interesting to me is I was looking through some tweets, of course, and they were talking about the big get was Susan Molinari. And they said, but you know what Susan Molinari's last job was? She was the top lobbyist for Google, I think is what they were saying.
Yes,
so it's like, so there's a kind of an interesting tie-in to Susan Molinari. Is she the Republican that we're thinking about, or are we thinking about the context in relationship with Google? Again, you're talking about wanting to go to the finance committee because they had the best hors d'oeuvres. I wonder if she's at those committee meetings beforehand.
Could be. This is a story that I think my prospect colleague, Dave Dayan, wrote a piece on that's on the Prospect website on Monday. And she was the representative from Staten Island, if I recall.
Yes, she was.
Which is, the only part of New York City that elects Republicans to Congress, although right now they happen to have a relatively centrist Democrat representing them.
Wow, unbelievable. So let's talk a little bit. So what I think people don't understand is I've been to a number of conventions, you've been to a number of conventions. What is, I think, important is there is this human relationship where, Alaska gets to meet Tennessee and Tennessee gets to meet Mississippi, and you find people, you find progressives within every state that you can sort of bond with. You find them sort of more centrist Democrats that you can bond with. And before social media, conventions were actually kind of important because you would walk away with addresses and phone numbers and share information. And I remember going to one of the conventions, and I have to tell you, I was a progressive liberal Democrat in the state of New Hampshire that, I had never seen the speaker's office because there had never been a Democratic speaker. So, and I was liberal within the Democratic wing, which is always a very moderate wing of the party in my state. And I felt like I was a crazy lady sometimes. And then I would go to these conventions and I would meet Minnesotans that sounded like me and Californians that sounded like me and people from Oregon that sounded like me. And all of a sudden I felt like, wow, so what I'm dreaming about and the legislation I imagine, it's been passing in other states. Right. I just didn't know it. And so I think what people didn't quite understand is that there was some significant benefit, not that it was the benefit necessarily of the speeches, but in a way, some of the relationships and the understanding of what your party kind of looked like and felt like.
Exactly. And, any large meeting of any group, sometimes the most significant interchanges go on outside the hall.
Yes, absolutely.
Somebody who is your unexpected soulmate from someplace else. And ideological soulmate, political soulmate, who knows what kind of soulmate, and you go from there. Now, it is true that beginning with the conventions of 1972, that the nominees were already anointed in primaries. It's important to realize that this was largely not the case until then. One reason the 1968 Democratic Convention, which I referred to earlier, was so contentious was that most of the delegates had been selected even before there were the McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy challenges to Lyndon Johnson. There was no, wow. There was no, primaries were a rarity. There were only, at the first convention I was at, again, harking back to 1960, only seven states had primaries. And it was, this was up to the political bosses and different forces like that in the various states. So before 1972, and actually even earlier, conventions were a place where deals were made up to and including who's going to be the presidential nominee. Right. So that function got taken away from them, but there's still many, many functions that they have served. And you just outlined a number of them, Arnie. I mean,
it was incredible.
They provide just a kind of a super networking and clarification of who you are and who they are. And
exactly.
Differences you don't otherwise find.
Okay, so there are two things I want to talk about. I want to talk a little bit about what you sort of said in your piece, and you wrote about the fact that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris delivered last Wednesday at the podium. They talked into a camera in a crowdless room. They were this is one of the most effective sort of speeches that they have given, you think, on their campaign trail. So I think in some ways they've been preparing for this different kind of feel, this different kind of delivery. You know, when you're out, speaking before tens of thousands of people, you react one way and you're very vibrant and you're moving your arms and your voice is going up and down. But when you're speaking in this way, it's much more intimate. People are much more aware. So there's a whole new way of addressing people that still wants them to understand that you are sort of policy oriented and you're going to bring the change they want, but you also want to kind of like them, in a very intimate way. So I think we're beginning to see that, at least if nothing else, they have practiced. It'll be very interesting to see how many of the other people that they have sort of are going to be showcasing over the next 4 days understand the medium they're working with.
Exactly. Now, they're up to now, there has been kind of sort of set standards for convention speeches. Some of them don't play at all. For instance, one-liners, a number of convention speeches go after your opponent, in particular, from a kind of humorous derision. I remember Ann Richards, the Democratic governor of Texas, was famous for this, once saying of George H.W. Bush, poor George, he was born with a silver foot in his mouth, which was, a big laugh line. Like, no one's going to do that in this kind of speech making. And also there's a kind of what I always sort of liked, the voice rising to the crescendo as you introduce the nominee. And the master of that, he himself was never the nominee, was Ted Kennedy, who I swear you could hear across a convention hall, even if he didn't have a mic. He was great. He's the guy you wanted to endorse a nominee. He would get the crowd roused up just from sheer volume. Okay, yeah. That does not work this time, and it's got to be a different kind of speech making. That's why I use the phrase, keynote whisperer. Some of this has to be more intimate, more personal. Now, it happens that Biden, in some ways, talks that way.
Exactly right.
Biden is a storyteller of stories that are sometimes moving and sad, and sometimes somewhat rousing. But I think he'd be comfortable in that, and I thought he was comfortable in that last week when he unveiled Kamala Harris as his running mate, and I thought they both did a good job in that kind of speaking. But it's different kind of speaking, and it's totally a different kind of speech writing. I mean, I've known a number of presidential speech writers, and this is sort of a challenge. Yeah, this is a new medium for them.
Well, let me tell you my little bit of my nervousness. So when the president gives the State of the Union address, and then the Democrats or whoever's out of office gives a response. Those responses are terrible. They're so terrible, and I'm thinking 4 nights of responses. That's what's made. Oh, yeah. Imagine, I mean, I'm terrified of that because they go flat. It's like they don't listen to each other. They have a prepared speech and it's like, didn't even matter what he said. And I'm thinking, no, you really should be responding to what the State of the Union was about. Yes. And the scripted piece doesn't necessarily work for you. So I'm a little bit worried about that. And then the other thing is, and I mentioned this to John Nichols of The Nation magazine, and I'm going to say this over and over again because I still think it's an opportunity lost. So you always want to start your event with something very sort of different and special where everyone feels like they're part of that event. And I don't know if you saw Barack Obama's graduation speech for the 2020 graduates who weren't going to have a graduation. Mm. So they did this, and what they did was really amazing, Harold. They had people singing from all over the 50 states, and they were in these little boxes, and it was music. And as they kept singing, another state would appear, and another young voice would appear. By the time they got done, you had these 50 amazing voices from all over the country singing, I don't know, God Bless America, America the Beautiful. I don't, but it was so, it caught your heart. It caught your heart. You felt for them, but you were proud of them. And it was such a magical moment. And what I said to John was, and I've said, can't hear me say this, John Nichols does an amazing thing when he gets into a crowd of people. And what he does is he has everybody stand up, okay? And then he says to people in the room, and you may have heard me say this before, in the city of people, I want all the women to sit down. I want all the African Americans to sit down. I want everyone under the age of 21 to sit down. I want all the renters to sit down. And he goes to this whole list. And by the time he's done, it's like five old men standing up in the room, you know? And he goes, welcome to 1776. This is how we started. This was all we had. They basically said everybody else was sort of outside, you know, the envelope of exercising the franchise. And then what he would do, it he'd bring them in one by, like group by group as we expanded the franchise. I would love to have seen that that's what we did, since the vote is so important. The diversity of America is so important. I would have loved it if the 2020 convention for the Democrats did something like that, because it would make you proud of being an American. It would make you understand that this has not been easy expanding the franchise, but the goal has always been to bring more in, not shut them out.
You know, I have led groups, are younger writing fellows and reporters from the American Prospect covering the two-party conventions. And, right. And in recent years, they've been back-to-back, first one week and then the next week the other. And one of the things I keep telling them is either way, you are going to go through complete culture shock when you move from one convention to the other.
Exactly.
Because Republican conventions effectively are all white and heavily male. And Democratic conventions, reflecting the demographics of the Democratic Party, are you will see the most integrated, multiracial, multicultural group of folks. And in large numbers that you may have ever seen, unless you've been in one of the recent Black Lives Matter demonstrations. But that wasn't the case 4 years ago or 8 years ago or 12 years ago. It really is culture shock. I mean, if the John Nichols experiment played at a Republican convention, you'd still have,
everybody in the room would be standing.
The room would still be standing at the end, yes. That's us.
Yes, and that's why I love that idea, because it's such a great visual. And having seen the 2020, graduation speech and how it worked, I could see something like that working for the Democratic convention. And I've been to Republican conventions, okay? I've had to cover them. And Ken has heard me tell this story. So I covered the convention right after 9/11, the one in New York for the Republican Party. All right, and that was probably the scariest thing I've ever covered.
Yeah.
And scary in a lot of reasons. I was hit by a drunken bicyclist, and I ended up breaking my arm and three ribs, but I still went to the convention. I mean, you can't even imagine it. But you mentioned it's all white, absolutely all white. But the other thing is, and I'll never forget this, a reporter said to me, Arnie, quick, come down and look at the floor, the convention floor. So I'm like, sure, what the heck? She goes, okay, and there's like three podiums on the convention floor. And she said, what do you see in these three podiums? Do you know what we saw? Crosses. Each of the podiums were done in wood, and the wood was laid out in such a way that there were three crosses on those podiums, one in each one. And she looked at me and she said, what the hell is this about? I mean, she was totally, and then I saw Newt Gingrich, and Ken knows this story. Newt Gingrich was on the radio with me, and I said, so Newt, what is this convention about? Because already I was getting nervous. And he said two words, Arnie, under God. Oh, and, my God.
And Newt Gingrich has been so far under God. As you know, when the angels fell, they fell very far under God, and I think that's probably where he has ended up. But the 2004 Republican convention, if that's the one you're talking about.
Yes, that's the one I'm talking about.
It was in New York City.
Yeah.
You know, the delegates, as I recall, you know, were in the New York City hotels. Now, New York City hotels around Broadway tended to name their rooms after theater figures. And so I remember going to a right-wing Republican caucus in the Clifford Odets room, who was basically in a communist writer. And even, I swear to God, a group meeting in the Bertolt Brecht room, who was literally a German communist, they were completely unconscious. But then again, I had once, the Socialist International met at the Waldorf Astoria in 1990 in the Cole Porter room. So this goes both ways. Republican conventions are oftentimes a cultural clash with the city that they're in. Cities increasingly are liberal, multicultural, multiracial, democratic, and Republicans, in a word, are not. That's a story in itself. This year, by not being in any city, they avoid that, but
yeah,
that's how it goes.
So, Ken?
Could I ask Carol? I always wonder this myself, but how is it possible that the millions of people in this country watch the Republican conventions with all that white bread and the white males who literally look like they're from 1776, and how do they think they're going to vote for them? How do they ever win? And yet they do.
Well, you know, it's mainly Republicans watching Republican conventions, and so they are either enthused by that or inured to that. Also, you don't really get the full effect until you're there. In fact, I remember...
You're absolutely right.
In the year 2000, when the Republicans nominated George W. Bush, the convention was in Philadelphia. And I remember, part of the TV experience at that convention was they kept trotting out African-Americans from Texas who liked Bush.
They sprinkle it in.
They do their version of it. I remember writing for the LA Weekly, where I was the editor at the time, that in Texas, if you're African American in Texas, you're either a friend of the governor or he executes you. It was very big on capital punishment. I also wrote that, if you're watching TV, this is like watching a negative of a photograph. You're getting race reversal. And if you actually saw the convention, hey, they're really all white.
They really are. So are people going to watch? I think they are. And I think the reason is this. One, they've constricted it down to 2 hours every night or whatever it is. It's going to be on right. And I think that because so many of us have been sort of stuck at home and we're sort of now more engaged in politics, I think, than we've ever been before. They really are seeing a lot of, no one's really kind of checked out. And I think in a lot of ways, it's kind of like the cliff notes of both parties.
Yeah.
If you really want to know what's going on, this is your cliff note version. And since you don't want to read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post and the American Prospect, you will get at least the essence and the themes of both. And yet, accomplish it in 8 hours.
Well, actually, the three traditional networks, CBS, NBC, ABC, say they're only going to do 1 hour from 10 to 11 Eastern time. The news networks, CNN and MSNBC, will do the full 2 hours and some pre-stuff. It remains to be seen what Fox News does. They're down for 1 hour. I suspect they'll do 1 hour for the Democrats and 2 hours for the Republicans. But
I suspect they're going to do 1 hour for the whole week. I mean, it's highly plausible. But I think the other advantage here, and you're talking about the fact that they're like negatives of each other, is that in a way you could create the split screen. in a way you've never been able to create the split screen, because it is going to be not only condensed, but it's going to be not a real convention. And therefore, the visual is going to be the entire essence of it. And I think some TikTok players or whatever they are, could have an amazing opportunity to explain in a lot of ways really what the essence of both of them are. And you could do it pretty simply.
Yes. Of course, you know, in traditional conventions, the cameras always cut away from the speakers to, you know, to people
in the hall
getting their reactions. If I can just cite my favorite example and go harking back again to 1968, as the police riot was going on in Grant Park, speaker was seconding the nomination of George McGovern, who had entered late for Kennedy delegates who didn't want to vote for Gene McCarthy. That was Abraham Ribicoff, the former Secretary of Health and Education and former governor of Connecticut. He was nominating McGovern, and he said, if George McGovern were president, we wouldn't have these Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. And a brilliant TV director cut to a reaction shot of Richard Daley, mayor of Chicago, and you could lip read what he was saying. Can I use obscenities on this?
No, you can't, because I got in trouble already.
What he more or less said was, F you, you MFing Jew, you. You could read that.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Live Tv, if you could lip read.
I'm going to go to C-SPAN. Yeah, I'm going to find you.
If somebody didn't hold him back.
In American conventions.
And Daley looked like he was going to rush the stage and beat up Ribicoff if somebody didn't hold him back. He was mad as a
bitch. Oh God, what a riot! Well, let me end with your last paragraph, because I said to my audience that we're Zooming this on Monday, so you will be writing something for Monday night. But we're going to sort of see what you wrote and then sort of look at what actually happened on Monday night. And you write, "Lord only knows how this will all play out. But however it does, I'll be writing about it in this space for the next 2 weeks, endeavoring for the Democrats to distinguish the new from the warmed over, what's left concealed as centrist from what's just plain centrist. And for the Republicans," this is my favorite line, "sorting the racism from the fascism and the big lies from the small." Yes. You are hilarious, Harold Meyerson. I have to admit, I'm reading this and I'm just roaring the whole time. So if nothing else, I encourage everyone, go to prospect.org. All week, you'll be able to read Harold and you'll be going, this guy's a really good writer. So thank you for covering the convention and actually introducing us.
Thanks.
Always all right, take care. It's always a pleasure. Harold Meyerson, editor at large at the American Prospect. All right, everyone, when we come back, we're going to be talking about Bella Abzug. All I'm going to tell you is the article at theconversation.com had me in tears. We'll be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, the convent of the Sisters of St. Joseph was severely damaged by flooding. The nuns moved elsewhere while repairs began. But the following year, lightning struck the roof and started a fire. The convent could not be saved.
We began to pray for some kind of a insight that would enable us to use the property in a way that would minister to the people of New Orleans.
Sister Pat Bergen says an architect came to the nuns with an idea, converting the 25 acres into a wetland that helps prevent flooding in nearby areas. They're calling the project the Mirabeau Water Garden. Plans for the site include recreational areas, meadows that absorb stormwater, and retention ponds. When the city's drainage system is overwhelmed, water will be diverted to the property and held there until it can be safely released.
Healing, strengthening, restoring earth was a major part of our decision making, and that's why this design resonated with our hearts right away.
So when the city breaks ground, it will turn what was once a major loss into a gain for the flood-prone city of New Orleans. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
It was 50 years ago an amendment was proposed to make the law state men and women equal. But little did we know just how long the fight would go, and even now we're working on its sequel. Because we can. she'd find the man or she's a jerk. And if she don't know her place, who cares what they pay her? We do, so no more debate, because we can't wait. We demand equality today, and it's fighting we must to make the law just. Sing it. E-R-A, E-R-A, E-R-A. E-R-A, E-R-A, E-R-A.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Monday afternoon, and you will hear it on Tuesday. So if something should happen Monday night, which I'm sure will because it's the first night of the convention, hey, you'll hear about it on Wednesday. Anyway, women in politics, being the first female to run for governor in the state of New Hampshire, a lot of remarkable women changed my life. And the woman that actually brought me into politics, she never knew it, was Shirley Chisholm. She came to speak to 400 white women in Concord, New Hampshire in 1984. And I was one of the white women in that audience because I was a poverty worker. And she basically said to us, are you frustrated with the clientele that you're trying to serve? Do you think the laws don't understand their lives? Do you think that you could make things better? And she said, if you think that you could change things, then why aren't you running for office? And she basically looked at us and said, take that knowledge, take their lives, and sit at the table. Help them rewrite the laws. And I don't know if there were 399 other people that disappeared, but Shirley Chisholm was talking to me. And I ran for the legislature in 1984. And then in 1991 or 92, I decided to run for governor. And she came to New Hampshire again for the second time in her life. And she gave a speech at this big women's conference. And she talked about how she'd always encouraged women to run for office. And she said, but now I really want you to go for the gold, go for governor, go for U.S. Senate, go for president. Don't just be for school board, not just the city council, not just the state rep, go for where the power is. And my little daughter, who was about 9 or 10 years old, Melissa, was falling asleep during this long, long conversation. And all of a sudden she woke up and she pulled on my arm, Pamela. And she said to me, Mommy, that lady's talking to you, because that was the year I decided to run for governor. Pamela Nadell is a professor at American University. She has the
Patrick Lundenin Chair
of Women and Gender History, and you're the director of the Jewish Studies Program at American University. You write for The Conversation, and you wrote a piece that was entitled, VP Pick Kamala Harris Stands on Many Women's Shoulders, Especially Bella Abzug's. And as soon as I saw Bella Abzug, I started to get so excited because I haven't sort of seen her name anywhere as we've been talking about all these women running for office and what's happening with Kamala. And I told you that when I went to Harvard as a fellow, they gave me her former office at the Institute of Politics. And I was so honored to be in her office. What they didn't know was that I was using a quote from Bella Abzug as the title of my course. And the quote was, you have to lose, lose, lose to win. And having been a two-time loser, Pamela, having lost for Congress and governor, I related to that. And I wanted my students to know that you don't run always winning, but that's not a reason not to run. And that you learn from losing, and that there's an opportunity with each loss to grow from that loss. Losses don't shut a door, they just open a new one. So you are a fabulous writer. Your piece about Bella had me in tears. So for an audience that doesn't know her, an audience that doesn't know why they should be celebrating her, John Kenneth Galbraith was absolutely right. If this was a just world, Bella Abzug would have been president. And when I read that, and then I read your piece, I'm like, God, can we bring her back today? Because if nothing else, she would be president. Because everything she fights for, and the way her fierceness, is so important. So Pamela, welcome to the program. I am so grateful you wrote this piece. And share with my audience the history of this really, really remarkable human being.
First of all, Arnie, it's so great to be here. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I was so excited when you said that you had been in Bella's office. And it's so interesting how we all call her Bella, because that those of us who were around and walked the earth when she walked the earth, that's how we think of her. She was a maverick. She was a woman completely ahead of her time. When I think of the legislation that she introduced in only 6 years in Congress, She gets to Congress. What's the first thing she does? She votes for the Equal Rights Amendment. What's the next thing that she does? She calls virtually on the day that she's inaugurated. She calls already for Nixon's impeachment. This is a year before Watergate. She authored the Freedom of Information Act. She introduced the first gay and lesbian rights equity bill into Congress in 1974. She was an advocate for clean water. She was an advocate for mass transit. She brought funding into New York when New York was in the throes of economic crisis. She wanted a living wage. She was a woman of our moment in time. But who was she?
She was, as you're saying all this, and the thing I want everyone to know is you're always told, like when you get to the, I was a young state representative, or you go to Congress, you're supposed to be quiet at the beginning. You're supposed to learn your place. You're supposed to sort of figure out where the doors are and who you trust and who to talk to. And so for the first couple of months, you know, you're getting oriented. What I love about Bella is I won. Okay, now I'm on. It was like 37 seconds later. It's like, I'm not wasting any time. She saw that as a waste of time instead of grabbing the opportunity. And that's what I so loved about her, is that she knew why she was there and there was no time to waste.
And when your point about being quiet, she actually, I mean, the Washington Post actually says when she gets inaugurated, when she's sworn in, remember, she's one of 15 women in a sea of over 400 men. And when she's sworn in, she has the official swearing-in ceremony in the House, and she has to take off her hat. But then, of course, she was very famous for her hat. So she has another swearing-in ceremony on the steps of the Capitol, outside, with Shirley Chisholm, by the way. And she's sworn in, and the Washington Post says she broke the first rule. Freshman congressmen should be seen and not heard. And she's out there vocally. But what's so important about Bella, and I wrote a book called America's Jewish Women, A History from Colonial Times to Today, and I wrote about her in that book in a different way than I wrote about her in this article in The Conversation, because what was so important to me was that she was a maverick, and she was inspired by her immigrant parents and her Jewish heritage to do what she did. And to give you just one example, when she was 13 years old, her father died. And in Jewish tradition, when a parent dies, a son is supposed to say a memorial prayer to commemorate the loss of this parent every day for an entire year. Daughters don't do that. It was the 1930s. Bella did that. Every morning on the way to school, she went to a synagogue where men and women sat separately, and she said the memorial prayer for the passing of her father. So at the age of 13, she was already a maverick. Then when she goes to Hunter College, the Women's College in New York City, she wants to become a lawyer. She applies to Harvard. What's the answer? No women admitted.
Yeah.
So she goes to Columbia. And what I love about her time at Columbia, not only that she made law review, but she refused to learn how to type because she knew that any woman who knew how to type, a lawyer coming out on the job market, was the first question always asked, can you type? She couldn't, you know, she could not have imagined the future when everybody would keyboard, even my husband, right?
Right, right. So Ken, tell Pamela about your mother. Well, this is incredible.
My mother was in Bella's class at Hunter College.
Oh my God.
She remembers Bella because obviously, even at Hunter, Bella was very vocal, very much a person, you know, she's no wilting flower. She would tell you what she thinks and she'd be happy to affirmatively, proactively tell you what she thinks on pretty much every topic. And she became, I think she was president of the student class, student government, whatever it was. And I remember when Bella was in Congress, my mother talked about how she was put off in college by the volume and assertiveness of Bella. But by the time she was in Congress, she just admired this woman so much about how, look, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing here. I'm going to speak out, tell you what I think, tell you what policies the country ought to be adopting. I say that this on the show all the time, that I think that's what we should be doing, all of us, not just politicians, but, you know, pretty much every day. Don't back down and compromise with, you know, let's do bipartisanship with Mitch McConnell. Stand up and say what you really think. And Bella sure as heck did that.
That was honestly, I'm weeping as I'm reading it because I'm so proud and I so related on so many levels. Let me just share something, Pamela. I didn't have supportive parents that believed that I could accomplish anything. My mother, I'm taking all AP courses in high school and stenography and typing. Okay, stenography and typing. Because my mother wanted me to go to law school, not to be a lawyer, but to marry a lawyer. And I needed a saleable skill. And it wasn't my brains, it was my stenography and typing. So when you wrote that Bella never learned to type, I'm like, oh crap. I'm like, why couldn't I have had a mother like that? And then, but let me just share something with you, because this is where it gets really interesting about the stenography and typing. So I have, I'm running for governor and I meet Mary McGrory. And Mary McGrory, the famous columnist from the Washington Post, I believe it was. And so Mary McGrory meets me in New Hampshire and she invites me up for lunch. So I knock at her door and she's staying at this little sort of cabin. And she looks at me and she looks down and she sees I'm wearing slacks. And she says, since when do governors wear pants? And I went, well, I guess starting now, all right? And then she sits down and we start talking. And I notice that she's taking notes in stenography. So I say to Mary McGrory, what kind of stenography are you taking? And then I gave the two kinds of stenography that you know, you either learn. And she goes, how do you know? And I said, because I know stenography, because my mother insisted upon it. So again, as I'm reading the piece, now you know why I'm crying, because I'm so proud of her to understand that she didn't want to type because she knew that that would basically put her into this little file cabinet and there was no way she was staying there. Unbelievable.
Incredible.
It's incredible. So give us a little, I mean, she was only in Congress for 6 years. Yeah. That's what's so amazing is that to a lot of us, I would have thought, oh, it's 20. I would have thought that given what she stood for and how many things that she, I mean, we so know her because she was such an incredible firebrand. What did she do either before she got there that we all kind of knew and expected this or after she left that she never really left the scene because it was too important?
It is really shocking that she was only in Congress for 6 years. And the reason, and she never won an election after her election to Congress. She ran for mayor of New York City in the primary, but the reason she left Congress, by the way, at a moment where her fellow congressmen and women had voted her the most effective member of the House of Representatives after the Speaker of the House and the majority leader. And she left because she ran for Senate and she lost the Senate primary by less than 1% of the vote to Senator, who became Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who did serve in Congress for, I think, around 2 decades.
Right.
So, and then after that, she ran for mayor, and she didn't win other elections. She did go on to found a very important NGO, Women's Economic Development Organization, but she was always there in the forefront of the fight, even when she wasn't a member of Congress. And of course, what we know so much about her, especially from the TV show about the fight over ERA,
right.
Mrs. America, the fight over ERA, was that she was appointed the head of that organization that planned the big conference that was supposed to succeed in getting the ERA through. But women's rights, civil rights, what today we would call green, all of these things remain her overriding passions. What's stunning is that she starts out as a labor lawyer, but not only as a labor lawyer, she also represents people like Pete Seeger, the folk singer, before the McCarthy hearings. She also was on her own testified before two grand juries, and we don't know much about what actually happened there, but she was never indicted in any way. But her politics were what we would call left of center, liberal, and in one of the most famous cases that she was involved with, and it really is a case that I think especially speaks to us today, is that in Mississippi, Willie McGee was accused of having raped a white woman with whom he claimed he had a consensual affair. And he was ultimately sent to the electric chair. She was not successful in defending him. But the vitriol that she, and also the danger that she faced during
tell that story, because she was pregnant. This is an amazing, I mean, I'm telling you, I cried throughout this whole piece because She is such a hero now. I want make this into a TV movie. Please, we need her now. Her immigrant story, what she did for Black Lives Matter needs to know that she's their hero too. Look what she did back then. And she lost a child. Tell them about what happened, because this is so important that Bella was so out there. And I mean, her guts is something that in some ways we need to all emulate.
She was so fearless, although she was afraid, but so fearless. So she goes down to Mississippi. And one of the things you have to understand is she's also very much out there as a Jewish woman. Yes. This is not a hospitable climate for Jews, let alone for African Americans. And when it's one of the appeals and she's down there and no hotel will let her stay in the hotel. And there's a man who is driving her around. And he says to her, I know a place, but it's far out of town. And she says to him, no, take me to the bus station. So I assume he does, because he thinks that she's just going to get on a bus and leave and not show up in court the next morning. Instead, she goes into the ladies' room. She's 8 months pregnant, goes into the ladies' room, spends the night in a ladies' stall while they are paging her on the loudspeaker there, because the vigilantes are looking for her to take her out of town. And in the morning, she says she actually goes someplace. There was somewhere where she was able to go and take a shower. And then she goes into the courtroom. And as she says, right after that, she loses this baby at 8 months. The doctor says it's from the stress or the strain or whatever. And of course, McGee is executed. And when the Jackson Daily News writes about this trial and writes about her, it says, this is a newspaper in a major city in America. It says, if Bella Abzug ever comes back to Mississippi as a lawyer or an individual, it will be one time too often. And then the paper actually says, it's too bad the courts couldn't send some lawyers to the electric chair along with their clients. Imagine what she faced. And so when you think of her running into Congress and standing up to all of those men in Congress that she's there with, you really understand the kind of woman that she was, who was so, so brave and who paid such a powerful price. The other thing that she did before she comes into Congress, and it's really how she gets to Congress, is she joins an organization called Women Strike for Peace. You have to remember that the 1950s is this terrifying moment. You and I are both shaking our heads because, yeah, like, we remember this, right? Remember ducking under the desk? We're going to survive a nuclear attack because we know how to duck and cover under a desk.
Yeah.
Bella Abzug doesn't let her daughters duck and cover under a desk. She thinks, first of all, they're not going to survive. Secondly, it's damaging to their psyches. And so the women who were involved in Women's Strike for Peace, who actually stand outside the White House and the Kennedy administration and said, when it rains, it pours, strontium 90, which was a radioactive isotope.
Isotope.
And they want to see Kennedy. Kennedy won't see them, but he won't see them in person, but Kennedy sees them outside the window of the White House. But it was the momentum out of that movement that helped propel her forward towards Congress. Because remember, when she gets elected, it's the height of the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And so she's elected on a peace platform, which is how she ends up calling for Nixon's impeachment, arguing that he has exceeded his presidential powers by sending more troops into Vietnam.
So how come no one has made this into, I mean, this is such a movie. And it's a movie we need now more than ever. Too many people don't read. We're so visual. We're so audio, you know, and I mean, your story and now hearing your voice, I see this. I produce it in my head and I want every little girl to see it. And I want every African American to see it. And I want people who understand what courage looks like to see it. It is so inspiring on so many different levels. And again, you bring the Jewish piece up. I am not Jewish, but everyone in New Hampshire thought I was. And so there are pieces in this story that you tell about this sort of the language that they used about her that was code for Jew. And you know what? That code happened to me. It happened to me in 96. It happened to me in 92. And it's because I'm a New Yorker. I have dark hair. I am aggressive. I went to law school. I mean, all these things. And they kept saying, one of the congressmen I was running against at one point said, you can't trust Arnie. She has New York values. And New York values, of course, was code for Jew. And when I lost the election, a guy who was a U.S. senator who actually won that year said to me, "Why didn't you tell people you weren't Jewish? You might have won." He said that to my face. And I looked at this U.S. senator, Bob Smith, by the way, in case you want to know Ken Barnes. And I looked at him and I said, "If that's what it would take, I will never say it. I don't want their vote." I mean, as if, so I'm reading the story of Bella and thinking she was so ahead of her time. And then I'm thinking, oh my God, I was channeling Bella, because so much of this experience is literally lived for me. And then I keep thinking about the women that are now running now in 2018 and 2020, and they too are living this experience, but they need to know that it is on Bella's shoulders they have climbed. This is not new. This is not unique. But we needed the Bellas to run so that we can see, you know, a vice presidential candidate, a child of immigrants, someone who's had to achieve so much and yet been pushed aside so often to be there. And we need these stories now more than ever, because I think it not only gives us hope, but it also gives us a sense of patience. You know, it doesn't always happen immediately, but it does change and it does happen.
What I'd like to remember about Bella is that she was born right before the ratification of the 19th Amendment. So look at how much had changed over the course of her lifetime.
Yes.
Right, and of course, and we're on the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which I find astonishing that American women have only been voting in the United States for 100 years.
Well, in my house, I've told the story before, there is a treasured black and white photo. It is a black and white photo of the 1921 New Hampshire legislature. Now, let me remind you, Pamela, we have a huge legislature. The only thing that's bigger is Congress. So we have 400 people. You know, they get paid $100 a year. That's all you get paid. And up until 1984, they only served every 2 years. Okay, so that was what it was. But the reason why my paperboy, literally, I love you, Flash, bought this picture. He's at an antique store. He goes, "I bought you something. You owe me $25. I'm like, "I don't need it." He goes, "You need this." And in this photograph from 1921, women get the right to vote in 1920, are two women. They ran as write-ins. They ran as write-ins. One Republican woman and one Democratic woman, and they are in that photo. And Flash reminds me all the time, Arnie, on their shoulders you climbed. So listening to you talk about Bella and the 100 years just before the 19th Amendment, and looking at that photograph and realizing the chutzpah of these women who decided, "We're getting the vote, we're running," and to organize and do that, I think people need to have that inspiration. They're worried about the election. They're worried about whether they should exercise the franchise. They're afraid of what might happen. Is it going to be revolution or is it going to be resolution? I don't care what it is. What we have to do is take that power that we've been given with the vote, and we have to have the courage to exercise that franchise. If Bella could lose a baby defending someone in Mississippi because of what she believed in, if Bella could stand up the first day she gets elected, you know, and isn't quiet, but sort of speaks the truth, how can we not vote? How can we not vote? It is so nothing compared to them. And in some ways, we honor them by voting, Pamela. We honor them.
Completely agree.
Can I ask you a question? Connect the dots between Bella and the present. Who would you see in the present political environment that is similar to Bella, or that Bella would resonate with, or that maybe Bella would be if she were alive now? Is there anyone? AOC, maybe?
AOC.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, she's another New Yorker.
Yeah.
She was super courageous. The speech that she gave after the invective that she heard from another member of the House, who was the equivalent of a person who she is. I mean, a comrade, a colleague, was so powerful. And Bella fought back against not only racism, but sexism and misogyny and anti-Semitism. I mean, she stood up against all of these racist evils. So I would think AOC is the one who has the most fire, like Bella, and then also gets criticized for it.
Exactly. So maybe we have to make the movie, and maybe the movie is Bella and AOC. Maybe the movie sort of threads these stories together. There's, you know, the kind where you go from one chapter to the other chapter to one chapter to the other chapter. So you're not quite sure what you're seeing, but you know you're seeing two different stories in two different time frames. And yet the stories seem so, so familiar. And that's what I loved about your piece at The Conversation. It was incredible. But for me, it was so familiar. And that's what was so shocking, because I didn't realize how I would see so much of her experience in my life. And AOC will see so much of her experience in her life. And yet it's been 100 years since she was born. And we need to remember that too. Thank you so much for writing this. I'm just going to encourage everyone, go to my Facebook page, go to The Conversation. Pamela, I hope they get calls all over, and I hope you write the screenplay. Her piece is entitled VP Pick, Kamala Harris Stands on Many Women's Shoulders, Especially Bella Abzug's. I hope Kamala reads this piece before she gives her speech this week.
I think somebody should read it at the convention.
Well, but I think Kamala should read it, because I'm sort of curious how she would respond, because I think this is such an inspirational piece, and you are a fabulous writer. So thank you so much. And American University is very lucky to have you. I really appreciate your showing up for us.
Thanks. It was great to meet you.
It was a pleasure. All right, everyone. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude, Zoomed on Monday afternoon. So the convention will be Monday night. We will talk and schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. Have a good day.